The following inspiring Torah class is brought to you by Nahle.com.
Okay, so we're going to talk about a few inyanim of Chanukah with as much as we can given the time. So the first, we say in Shir HaShirim, those of you who love Shir HaShirim the way I do, Tzenu Re'ena Benot Zion B'melech Shalomo B'atarash Yesh B'lo Imo B'yom Chatunato B'yom Simchat Libo. Go forth, daughters of Zion. See Melech Shlomo, Hashem, the King, who is the King of all peace, who made it all, who calls it all together. See him when? On the day of his wedding, the day his heart rejoiced. What are we talking about? So the day of Matan Torah was the day of the betrothal. But the day of the wedding was Chanukah Tamishkan, when finally the bride and the groom, Hashem and us, are together in a dwelling place. About the Mishkan, it says, Asuli mikdash v'shachanti b'tocha, make me a dwelling place and I live in you, not in it. So that moment of absolute unity, okay, that is something unforgettable. Every single part of the Mishkan, every single aspect of the Mishkan, has profound meaning if you want Hashem to be in you and with you. Okay, so I'm going to read you a tiny little quote from the Rif. Yesh misha katav shalafichach korim chanukah klomar chanu bekaf hei. There are those who say, actually it's the Ran on the Rif, that the reason why Chanukah is called Chanukah because they rested on kaf hei. Asum yamim tovim v'kolkach v'chen ketuv adram b'sidra shelo. Okay, so the idea is that this is when we were ready. We were ready for this. Okay, so what does it mean to have Hashem dwell within you? I'm going to take you through what was happening in the Mishkan and focus on the menorah. So the Mishkan is the place of dwelling. So there's an outer room and an inner room. We're only going to talk about the outer room. So on one side, north, you have the table. The table looked like a table, other than it has two planks on either side, and these planks have various apertures that could hold the lechem hapanim, which were huge loaves that were shaped like boats facing each other. So what does that tell you? You want Hashem to live with you? You have to have a table. And on your table there has to be means of support, supporting all 12 tribes. They're all part of you. But a body, even a sanctified body, a body is just an envelope for something bigger than itself. The purpose of the body is to give the soul a means of being expressed. So let's leave the table and move to the other side, south, and you see the menorah. The golden menorah. 32 tefachim high. The number 32 is the gematria of the word kavod. Kavod means honor. Our sense of significance doesn't come from our bodies, it comes from our souls. So the seven branches of the menorah parallel the seven traits that we have in common with Hashem. Chesed, Gvura, Tiferet, Netzach, Hod, Yisod, Mochut. So this is our pride, this is our heart. The Kohen would get onto the three steps and light it, and at that moment the hearts of all Am Yisrael were ignited, consciously or subconsciously. And then things began to happen. The era of the Mishkan ended, the era of the Mikdash began. If anything, the intensity of connection was greater. But then something happened, and again I'm going to take you to Shir HaShirim. Ani Yishena V'libi Er. I'm asleep, but my heart's awake. You could get used to anything. You could even get used to going to the Beis HaMikdash and feeling connected. And even that could be, well, yeah, what did you have? What did you do today? I had some spiritual ecstasy. What's new by you? You can get used to anything. So we reached a point where we were asleep. But our hearts are always awake. So this is very much where we are today also. We're in deep slumber. We hear about things that are joyous, things that are tragic. Nothing wakes us up. The only time we're really awake is when our heart forces itself into beating so loud that it causes the blood to circulate and air to enter our lungs. So Rabbi Nachman explains that. He says that the Hadam Hu HaNefesh, blood is your soul, the heart pumps your blood. What soul are we talking about? The animal soul. We're driven in a million different directions, but we also have a need for air. So there could be what we'll call Ruach HaKodesh, there could be Ruach Tuma. There's the search for meaning that takes you to further and deeper blockage, or the search for meaning in life and being really there that takes you to higher and higher levels of Kedusha. We reached a point where we were doing the former. We wanted to feel alive, but we were going further and further and further into the Tuma of Greece. The Tuma of Greece, okay, was with us from that period of time, the end of Bayit Rishon already. The Greek civilization, not where we could see it, but where it was beginning to get its grounding. We were conquered by the Babylonians. Babel, confusion. They were conquered by the Persians, the materialists. The Persians allowed us to go back and build the second temple. It was then that the Greeks raised their head in a way that touched us. What were the Greeks like? What was so appealing about them? They created what we would call the human-centered world, the ecocentric world. Until then, even in the eyes of the non-Jewish world, the world was God-centered. People believed in false gods, in gods that were the creation and fruit of their imagination. But the Greeks created a human-centered world, which is the world we live in now in Western culture, where if you think it's true, it must be true. If you feel this is right, it must be right. There is no accounting. There is no higher being. And in fact, they felt threatened by the concept of there being a higher, anything higher. So let's look at these two psukim, because they seem to be almost shouting each other. Hear me. No, hear me. Tzena re'ena b'not ziyan b'melech shlomo batara she'tralo imo b'yom chatunato b'yom simchat libo. Go, see, King Shlomo. Okay, on the day of his wedding, he's wearing the crown his mother put upon him, which is a phrase we have to explain on that day. What's the crown? The crown is awareness. Who's Hashem's mother? So the Gra explains the Jewish people are sometimes called Hashem's mother. How so? The function of a mother is to nurture the baby within her and then bring him out to the world. This is what the Jews did. No one knew Hashem. They knew nature. They saw the harmony in nature and the power of nature. They worshipped natural forces. Then Avraham Avinu came on the scene. He brought the source of all nature into him. And then he brought Hashem into the world. Okay, so we say the Shema. Okay, we say, V'ahavta et Hashem Elokecha, Elokecha Hashem, your God. He's our God, meaning we brought him into the world. We introduced him to the world, so to speak. The world was blind. So, look at Shlomo in his glory. The day that the Mishkan was there, we could dwell with him. And in which he's constantly, the Atara, he's wearing the crown his mother placed upon him. Such joy. And now, Ani Yishena. Libi air. I'm so asleep. I'm so tired. I'm so, so tired. The function of the Greeks was to wake us up. So our slumber, which is our escape from anything that's living, was something that Hashem forced in our face to recognize as such. Okay, so let's talk a little bit now, a little bit, about the Greeks. Okay, so it says about the Greeks that they darkened our eyes with their decrees. What were their decrees? So you're familiar with this. You know that they made decrees against keeping Shabbos, against appointing Rosh Chodesh, against Brit Milah. But you don't have the baby every week. And the calendar was just around the corner. Could be calculated. Shabbos is important. But why were the Greeks so oppositional to things that appeared to be not that big? Not that big on the horizon. So they circumcised their children. How often is a boy born? And it's only to one civilization. So they have a different calendar. Okay, what's the deal? So the deal is that when you talk about reality, you're talking about Olam, Shana, and Nefesh. You're talking about the world, you're talking about time, and you're talking about souls. That's reality. The Mekubalim will abbreviate Ashan, Olam, Shana, Nefesh. So they saw themselves as conquerors of reality. They define what time is. They define what a soul is and where it should be placed. They have the right, because it's a human-centered world, remember that from their perspective, okay, to say that the world itself is theirs. And now we have people who are saying, no, 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 no. Nefesh. Okay, nefesh is the word that describes the aspect of the soul that we experience through the body. It comes from nefesh, it rests, the soul rests against the body's walls. So when you hear beautiful music, it's nefesh self that feels exalted. One of the mitzvot that is very anti-intuitive is Brit Milah. Who would ever think of it? Why? The statement of Brit Milah is that your nefesh, not just your neshama, your higher self, but your nefesh is sanctified. The lower self, the self that engages in bodily experience, such as urination, that has the capacity to have eternity in it through having children, or be completely degraded through misguided, desire-oriented activity, or attain the holiness that's only attained through marriage. Look who we are. Okay, you dwell in our tents. Your part, our nefesh, has the imprint of Hashem. Okay, then, let's look at time. Let's look at time. People often think of time as being a construct that humans made up in order to be able to make their lives more organized. So it sounds better to say, meet me at 6 than meet me when you're finished with supper. Okay, it's not that. Time has essential reality. When Hashem created time, he had something in mind. He was going to hide it behind the concealment of nature, but still give us the opportunity to meet with him by allowing the sun, the stars, the moon to create holidays and days in which we'll meet up with him, we'll remember things that occurred. They didn't want us to do that. They wanted time to stay parov. Well, today is no different than yesterday. What do you mean the spirit of the times? Okay, in America, for instance, they have President's Day. It was too laborious to have school off and work clothes on so many different days, and there were so many presidents that they wanted to memorialize. So they said, okay, it's nobody's birthday, it's nobody's yahrzeit, we're just going to call this President's Day. And all of the presidents who need to be honored, George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, the whole lot of them will be honored on this one day. What we would say in Judaism is completely different. We say things like, what time is Shkia? Why? Because I can't daven Mincha after Shkia. We say things like, what day does Pesach Seder come out? Let's say Shabbos, so it means we're going to have 3 days. Why don't we just give ourselves a break and have all holidays take place on Wednesday? What's going on? So the idea is we believe that there is latent spiritual force out there that we could grab onto if we want to, or else it could be nothing. So we could sanctify time, or else we could be living in a vacuum in which today and tomorrow and the next day are all basically the same day lived again and again. The Greeks said, time is what you make it. There is no outer force. There's nothing to be celebrated except your own life. They were threatened by Rosh Chodesh, as they were by Brit Milah. So there, okay, so we have the Nefesh, Shana, and then there's Olam. Olam. The word Olam, as we know from many shiurim, is related to the word Ne'olam, which means concealed. So the 6 days of creation conceal and reveal Hashem at the same time. What do I mean? Before there was creation, there was just Hashem's glory, which we can't imagine. But as soon as he began creating things, light, dark, up, down, world, there's other. You could live an entire life and just see the superficial realities. So this possibility is hinted at by two different things. One are the weekdays, and the other is the basic halachic structures of response to the weekdays. There are 6 weekdays. The 6 weekdays are comparable to the 6 directions, 4 sides and up and down. Everything physical fits that paradigm. This box has 6 sides. But even if it was something that was totally different, not box-like at all, this bracelet has 6 sides. It still has 4 sides and up and down. Okay, the 4 sides are there. Look at the edge of this bracelet. But everything that's three-dimensional also has an inside that's not surface. So when you're talking about the world offers you an enormous amount of physical sensation, color and taste and texture, but it also presents you with a deep need to find meaning. Shabbos is there for meaning. So it's the aspect of reality, it's actually the aspect of the world that's not surface. And the Greeks did battle with that, because to them, the surface is the world's message. You turn it into whatever you want. So the Greeks were ready to do battle to the death to the Jews, because their challenges to Greek think were so threatening. Now, when you hear about the Maccabean Wars, usually we picture... like we did in kindergarten, we have the pictures. The Maccabee soldiers who look like they live in Geula, okay? And the Greeks, with their spears and their shields, okay? It wasn't exactly like that. It was also, there were Jews who were alleged with the Greeks. A lot of Jews were Hellenists. And it took the oppression of the Greeks to bring them to their senses. I want to share with you something that I heard in yesterday's news. I'm not sure when this happened. It happened this past week. It might not have been yesterday, though. So, in Israel, there are usually 2 big parties, but their names change all the time. So, you know, Gachal morphed into Likud, and Mapai morphed into Avodah, which morphed into the Zionist Front. But there are always these 2 parties. The more right-wing party that has greater attachment to the land and to the people and to the traditions, and the left-wing party that has more attachment to liberalism and nationalism. Okay, nothing new here. One of the heads of the left made a very interesting speech. He said, we're forgetting that we're Jewish. We've created a new set of beliefs, a new religion, if you will, called liberalism. Now, for him to say this is an amazing thing. Now, on one hand, the cynic in me is saying, well, he wants to get some of the right-wing voters who's been voting for his opponents. But he might have meant it, because people know that that's true. So why am I telling you this? What does this have to do with Hanukkah? Hanukkah celebrates our fight against what was the liberalism of the ancient world, the belief that you could have righteousness and conscience without God. And in fact, the God would be an interruption to all of that. Okay? So they made other decrees. Another decree was that before a young woman could marry, she had to spend the night with the Roman officer, with a Greek officer. Another one, and this is the one that we'll discuss, is that they were commanded to write on the horns of their oxen, "Ein li chelek b'Elokai Yisrael," I have no portion in the God of Israel. Now this requires a lot of explanation. First of all, who writes on an ox horn? And why would you write on the ox horn? And what is this message meant to convey, that it needs to be written on an ox horn? So I want to talk, I talked to you a minute ago to the Mikdash, right? Here we are in the Mishkan, the table, the menorah, between them the incense altar. Okay, we're in a holy place. Let's envision the opposite. Let's envision the worst of all possibilities. So after the Jews fell asleep, there were attempts at tshuva. There were little openings, but never ones that we grasped at. So finally, it says that Hashem knocked on our doors. What do we say? How could I open the door? I'm already undressed. It's too hard. And finally we say, what did I do? Which is where I think this politician is at. What did I do? And you open the door, but he's not there any longer. He wants you to pursue him. He wants you to extend yourself. He wants you to create relationship. So, Ein li chelek b'Elokai Yisrael is what the Greeks wanted to say is a statement of loyalty to them and to their ideals. That there is no such thing as Elokei Israel. There's some sort of universal spirit of generalized goodness that has to do a lot with the Greeks. Okay? So it says that the Egyptians were after the Jews in a literal sense. They would fight with them if they didn't keep all of their ridiculous laws. Further, okay, there's a rescue. There's always a rescue before there's a defeat. So the Jews feel defeated. They lost their land, their temple. They're driven out to Babylon. Now for them, this was the worst of all fates, and I want to tell you why. We live thousands of years after the exile, so what do we know that they didn't know? We know that we survived anyway, but they didn't know that. They thought it was the end of the story. And there's a reason why they thought it was the end of the story. No people ever survived without a land, language, and culture for very long. So Hashem gave Yecheskel a vision in Babel. The vision was the Merkava. He shows how he moves from his place of unknowable infinity to this world. The Merkava had four figures on it, a lion, an ox, an eagle, and a human. The only one we're going to talk to is the ox. Take your ox and write on its horn, Ein li chelek b'Elokai Yisrael, write, I have no portion of the God of Israel. What's that about? What that's about is that an ox is the strongest of all of the domesticated animals. A lion is the strongest of all of the wild animals. But an ox is the strongest of all of the domesticated animals. Meaning, you teach, how does an animal become domesticated? You take it to your home, you give it food, and before you know it, he thinks he owns the place. That's how it happens. There are farm animals that are domesticated. You need worker on your farm, so you feed them, and then they're willing to work for you. Okay, the shor is the strongest of all of the domesticated animals. You can put it to the plow, it'll plow your field. Yitzchak was compared to the ox. So Yitzchak could take the challenge, no matter how big the challenge was, no matter how abnormal the challenge was. He could take it. He had the strength for it. So in Yecheskel's vision, he saw this worked. The Avos brought the Merkava down to earth. The Greeks also saw it would work. And you know who they were most threatened by? They were threatened by the horn. Yitzchak's horn. That was scary. Why? Because in a human-centered world, who sets the rules? We do. Who decides when the other guys should be punished? We do, and the punished far away. We never think about it, that there's another force that keeps people from becoming thieves, not just their desperation. So we're all in Bavel, and we all are in despair. And Yechezkel shows us this vision, and he says, you know what? You are the ox. There's a part of Avram in you, you're a lion. There's a part of Yitzchak in you, you're an ox. You have the vision of David, you're an eagle. And you have the Tzelem Elokim, you're a human. So the Greeks said, you ride on that ox horn. Einli chelek b'elokai Yisrael. The ox follows my lead. I'm holding the plow. Why are you talking about God? Why are you bringing God into this? Why were they? Because we believe that God is the God of Brit Milah, of Shabbos, of Rosh Chodesh. He's there in Olam Shana Nefesh. We don't have any power that's independent of Hashem's power. But the Greek ideas were very appealing to us. And in fact, remember a moment ago we were talking about the Mishkan? We said it has two chambers. The two chambers together are called the Heichal. The word Heichal in Gematria is 65. The word Yavan in Gematria is 66. Yavan is more attractive than Heichal. Why? I want to show you why. I want you to see. You hear something in the background, you know what that is? It's our local mosque. Okay, so, we are still in exile. Okay, so look at the letters of Yavan in your mind's eye. Line, bigger line, biggest line. A line connects two points. The way Yavan said is, we are here and we could discover anything and bring our light, the Olympic torch, to any place. We can do anything if we want to. In 1965, there was a World's Fair in Long Island, and the different countries had exhibits. America, of course, had, guess what, the smallest or the biggest exhibit. Yes, you've got it. Okay. But the American exhibit wasn't a patriotic exhibit. It wasn't like the American presidents or history. No, it was industry. So the big masters of industry, General Motors, okay, a lot of the big companies had huge, huge displays. So one of them was all of the manufacturers who make kitchen equipment, refrigerators, stoves, they're all on display there. And they roll past you, like this is all sound and light, so really they're rolling on conveyor belts, but it looks like they're mysteriously floating in the air past you. And you hear, we can make life better for you. Who? You ready? The food manufacturers. Now you know how your life will get better. Frigidaire, refrigerators, okay. Westinghouse. That's what the Greek thought, and it was very attractive to us. It's very empowering. So letting go of that wasn't so easy. Now, there was another part that was even more painful and difficult. Not only were they saying that God is unconnected to the world, they also had a lot of wisdom there. So I want to talk to you a little bit about Greek wisdom. Some of you have learned Rambam, especially if you listen to Naaman, okay? And you're familiar with his thesis of the Shvil HaZahav, the golden way. So I'll say in terms of personality development, there are extremes. There's some people who throw money around. There are other people who are so stingy that they can't even bear buying anything for themselves. There are some people who are always angry. They wake up angry. They go to sleep angry. They're furious. Other people are so passive that they never get angry at all. And if they do, it's once in many years. There are people who are kind. There are people who are cruel. And after he names us quite a number of pairs, he says that all extremes are bad. So that means if you take any trait and you do you use it excessively, it'll be bad. If you use it not enough, it'll be bad. What you need is the middle. So an example of that, anger. Too much anger is bad. It's a certain form of self-worship, and it doesn't get you what you want. Passivity is bad. It's laziness. It's a certain kind of self-worship, and it doesn't get you what you want. The middle path would be expressing what you need to express calmly, in a way which the other person hears you, rather than passivity or rage. So after he finishes taking you through these extremes, he says, and a person who walks that path is walking towards Hashem. And he says, this is what's meant when we say Har Hashem, God's mountain. You have to move yourself step by step till you reach it. Okay, that's what Rambam says. Find the middle, and if you're in an extreme, go to the opposite extreme so you'll hit the middle. And then you'll get to God's mountain. Here's how Aristotle would say it. Now I'm Aristotle. There are people who are enraged continually. There are others who are completely passive. Both are evil. Extremes are evil. You must find the middle. The same thing with money. There are those who throw money around senselessly, and those who can't bear spend. Okay, he sounds like he just finished learning Rambam. But I want to tell you the critical difference. For him, finding the middle path is the end of the story. It doesn't take you anywhere. For Rambam, it takes you to Hashem. The difference between these views is vast. So the fact that Aristotle was no doubt an extraordinarily wise person made him, if anything, more dangerous to us. Because excluding God from your inner self, from your core personality, from your wisdom, is the worst place to find yourself lacking in him. So now, let's go back to Hanukkah. We were talking about the Greek, let's talk about Hanukkah. So here we are, years later, we woke up. Amazing! Okay, we woke up. Okay, so we woke up not in spite of the Greeks, but because of the Greeks. We woke up and we did battle against them. So here you are. Be with the Maccabim. You're entering the Beis HaMikdash. Everything is defiled. Everything is defiled. You finally find this one bit of oil with the chotemet of the Kohen Gadol. And you light the menorah. You there? So now we'll ask the old question, Beis Yosef's question. That's wonderful. You lift the menorah day one with enough oil for day one. Why do we say Al Hanisim in day one? What's miraculous about lighting a light using enough oil? In other words, would you find yourself saying like, wow, as a mess, if you filled a cup of water and it contained water? Like, wow, if you struck a match and it lit. Okay, so what's the nes? So you would say, right, day two, the oil lasted twice as long as it was supposed to. Day three, day four, but why day one? So this is not a particularly original question for you. The Beit Yosef asked this question a long time ago, and there are thousands of answers. But I want to share an answer that has a special appeal to me. When the Jews came into the Mikdash, and they found that one vial of oil, and they lit the menorah, they were doing so with a sense of, this is what I fought for. I want to light the menorah. Ner Hashem Nishmat Adam. Hashem's candle is the human soul. I want it to be a flame again. I don't want this kind of sleep of passivity and contentment and spiritual death. I want to live. So that merit of the first day, the Lev Tahor that they had in the first day, that's worth celebrating. Now, how was that a miracle? The miracle, before we saw that the candle, that the lights would stay lit for 8 days, was, of course, what we say in Al Hanisim, the miracle of the war. Rabban biyad ma'atim, many were defeated by the few, tmeim biyad tarm, the impure by the pure, etc. Where did the merit for that war come from? They There are Jews who are Hellenists still. Where did the merit kit come from? The merit came from this, I want you to hear this, this is a Svasemis word, from this that they wanted to defeat evil. They wanted to have the menorah lit. So all of the nisim that happened until they walked into the mikdash were epitomized at the moment that they lit the menorah the first night. The oil is not what's important. The taharat halev and the desire to win is what's important. So now you bring this back to yourself. We want connection with Hashem. We want to be alive. We don't want to spend our lives sleeping. The message of Chanukah is, are you ready? So don't. If that's not what you want, don't. Olam, Shana, Nefesh, it's your world. You could elevate it to Hashem by sanctifying your body, by using your time in a way that there's Kiddush Hashem, by using your way of finding reality, okay, your soul. Use it as Kiddush Hashem. Don't settle for darkness. So an important thing about knowing this is now that Chanukah has two aspects. One is we had a want to make light, and the other is Hashem made it awfully dark. It's from Hashem. That's what woke us up. So Chanukah isn't a holiday like other holidays. It's not like Shabbos where it was part of Maisa Bereishis. And it's not like the other holidays that we have to consecrate, but are there potentially in heaven. Chanukah is chol, it's an ordinary weekday. You don't have to have a su'uda. No? Okay, you don't have to have a su'uda, you don't have to make kiddush. You're allowed to do everything. Hashem is saying, you find me in the darkest places. I want this candle to be lit on a weeknight. On the night when everything is permitted. That's when you light it. And you have to light it in a way in which other people see it. People have to see that you're not asleep. You have to bring this message to the world. Olam, Shana, Nefesh, it all should connect you to God. This is why you have to also put it by the petach, by the opening. The Svasemis says it's a play on words. The sense of being alive has to be by the petach of your heart. You have to not let yourself sink into the despair of just living day by day by day by day. And I want to tell you, this is just my opinion. Until now, I was pretty careful about staying with Torah. I think that we're falling into a new kind of slumber, one that's even heavier than any of the ones we've experienced before. Here in Israel, when I came, until very recently, there was such a thing as a split shift day. Most women worked until 1 or 2, in offices, in stores. And then somebody else would come and work from 4 to 7. That was normal. Most women worked split shift. Most women worked only half a day. That meant the parents and children got to see each other more than just passing. It's the government's policy now to encourage people to work all day long. So one of the ways they do this, I have children who work in early childhood. They now have afternoon gan. It's called Saharan. And it only costs 50 shekel. So real gan in the morning costs much more. But the goal is for women to addict themselves to sending their children to gan so they'll work all day long and make more and more and more money and have less and less and less to do with anything that isn't physical. So we're entering a culture here that's been alive in America for ages. You're here to earn it so you could spend it. That's what it's all about. I see this as very dark. So just affirming that you believe in life and you believe in light and you believe that every person is a B'Tselem Elohim, which is the message of the menorah, and you believe that you could have it if you want it, which is what lighting on the first night's about, is worth retaining. You have to be committed to retaining it. You have to want to retain godliness within you and within the world. That's what I'll leave you with, and you should have a very happy Chanukah.